You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Every year, one thing is always predictable. Postage costs go up. Stamps.com gives you crazy discounts of up to 89% off USPS and UPS services, so your business will barely notice the change. Stamps.com has been indispensable for over 1 million businesses just like yours. It's like your own personal post office. No lines, no traffic, no waiting. Sign up with promo code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com code PROGRAM.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.
Feel like who Art Ed?
We're trying to spice it.
Who Art Ed?
Mr. Wood, Art Ed, me.
Good. Either way, it's ambiguous. It works on so many levels.
I know.
That's off to a great start.
Welcome to Who Arted, where we explore visual arts in an audio medium. I'm your host, Kyle Wood, and joining me today, I have Myrtle, the host of an upcoming podcast, The Series of Dysfunctional Events. Thank you for taking the time to join me.
No problem. I'm happy to do it.
Oh, I was really happy to talk to you because one of my goals is to celebrate art in all of its forms. But I'm going to be honest, I am not a fibers guy.
Like, oh, okay.
I like a lot of different stuff. I respect it, but my sewing skills are garbage.
Oh, well. Everybody can learn.
You would think everybody could learn, but I had a sewing machine for the longest time. I tried. I can hand stitch a couple things, like, you know, when I rip my clothing or whatever, or lose a button, I can do it. It's ugly, but it functions. But that is a skill that I just have never been able to master. But I know that you are very much into quilting and fibers.
Yes. And I grew up with that.
Yeah, and I appreciate that you're lending that expertise and that experience, because we're talking about Faith Ringgold, who also grew up with fibers.
Mm-hmm. And I think she's amazing.
I would definitely second that. But before we get into that, I do want to make sure, because, you know, when somebody is generous enough to join me on my show, I want to make sure that I start off by plugging their pluggables. And as I said, you have your own podcast coming out. It's going to be starting on October 1st, called A Series of Dysfunctional Events. I love the playoff, like the Lemony Snicket series of unfortunate events. But A Series of Dysfunctional Events will be out on your favorite podcast apps starting October 1st. And listeners can learn more about your show on dysfunctionalevents.com. Is that right?
That's right. That's right. I have a whole website there for people to contact me and get a hold of me.
Yeah. And so I will definitely be listening to that as it comes out. And I will make sure that I leave you a rating or review on the podcast apps. And I would encourage listeners to do the same, because launching a podcast is a lot of work, and everybody who leaves ratings and reviews is doing something kind for others, and it costs you nothing. So please help your favorite podcasters leave a rating or review on whatever apps you're using. But now, now we're going to get into Faith Ringgold.
Yes.
I was really interested in her story. You know, as an elementary art teacher, I first became aware of Tar Beach, just as the picture book that we would put out. That, because, you know, when you're teaching the younger kids, a picture book, a story always is so compelling. Yeah. And that's where I first learned about her. I started off seeing Tar Beach in other elementary classrooms probably from the time I was student teaching, because it really hit in like 1990, but we're going to go way back to the beginning here.
Yeah.
So she was born October 8th, 1930 in Harlem, New York. So like this was the time of the Harlem Renaissance.
Jazz.
Jazz. I mean, she said she was like surrounded by a whole lot of stuff. But also at the same time, when we think of America in 1930, the Great Depression, yeah. You know, I mean, she grew up a child of the Depression. One thing I found really lovely, though, was she talked about how she grew up in the Depression, but she said that she was surrounded by and protected by her family. And I love that because I read so many stories and so many biographies that are informed by trauma. And certainly, yes, she has not had an easy life. There have been plenty of things that were awful, you know, in the experience of, you know, growing up in 1930s and, you know, a black woman in, you know, that time period, all sorts of stuff. But I love that she had a loving support system.
I do too. I think that's what created her. It has to have helped, because even during the Depression, it didn't seem to affect her. Her family helped her through that.
Yeah.
And that's great.
Yeah. And her family name at the time was Jones. She was born Faith Jones. And her family came up to New York during the Great Migration. That was the time period where a lot, like especially in the Jim Crow South, a lot of African American families moved up from the South up to the North to get a little bit better treatment and better opportunities, although still a lot of the same struggles persisted. Yeah. Her mother was a fashion designer and seamstress. I guess she was pretty successful in that vein. And
I did see that.
And obviously that would play out later on in this story of Faith Ringgold and her development as an artist. Her father worked a variety of jobs. I mean, in the 1930s, I think everybody was working a variety of jobs to make ends meet. The household, though, because her mother was an artist. Her mother was a designer and a seamstress. And like I said, Harlem in New York at that time was a really vibrant art scene. She grew up in a household that encouraged her creativity. And, you know, she was surrounded by artists. I mean, Langston Hughes and Duke Ellington were like just around the corner.
I can't imagine.
I know. Like Sonny Rollins, for listeners unfamiliar with jazz music, Sonny Rollins was a well-known prominent jazz musician, but also like her childhood friend. So he would come over and play the sax at parties and stuff like that.
That would be great.
It just sounds amazing. It's cool to see these stories where so many creative, brilliant people seem to cross paths. And I don't think it's an accident. I think a lot of times these people who have that passion and that drive for the arts and for whatever field, they find each other and they support each other and they become great because of that interaction, I think.
With supporting each other. It sounds like she had creativity all the way around her as a child, and it really helped her to be creative.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And the other thing that I think helped her to be creative was she had asthma. And this reminds me of the story of who was the guy who created Garfield?
Davis?
Yeah, Jim Davis.
Yeah.
He also had asthma as a child. And so, like, you know, she's inside a lot. She's not running around so much. Like, the air quality, like, it can irritate her. And so she's at home. She's drawing. Her mom gives her, you know, crayons and teaches her to sew.
She finds an outlet.
Yeah. It's her thing.
Yep. And I get that.
And I think that's beautiful. Like I said, her mom was encouraging her as well as teaching her skills, passing it on through the family. Yep.
That's how we create great artists, isn't we? Isn't it?
It's so the tough. Ultimate apprenticeship.
Yep.
And so then 1948, she enrolls in the City College of New York. And she wanted to major in art, but I guess at that time, and this is one of those things that just like makes my brain hurt.
Me too.
Women were only allowed to enroll in certain majors. So she got pushed into art education, which so much to unpack there. It's, you know,
Thank God it's changed.
Yeah.
I can't imagine.
Well, it's like, it's not only disrespecting women as learners capable of tackling any subject that they choose and want to dedicate right. themselves, but also it's putting education in this lesser category as well, you know?
Oh yeah, I get what you're saying. The two are important.
Yeah, it kind of matters who's in that classroom and leading it.
Sure
or at least I like to think so.
Yeah, definitely.
So then she started there in 1948. 1950, she's married to a jazz musician. She has two kids. They divorced after just a few years because of a substance abuse disorder. At that time, you know, she's meeting different artists. She, like I said, she's married to a jazz musician. Obviously, she's going to be in that scene.
And I know all of them.
Yeah, and she continues to study and she continues to grow in her practice. One of the things I found really interesting, though, when I think of like the mid to late 20th century, you know, I'm picturing the civil rights movement, the feminist movement. But one of the things that, again, just really disappointing is the civil rights movement, you know, and a lot of those movements around Black empowerment were often focused on Black men, and the women's liberation, the feminist movement, was often focused on white women. And Faith Ringgold, as a Black woman, was not always getting the support that other people were getting as people were reaching for equality. And so one thing I found really cool was, in, I think it was the 1970s, she actually formed an artist collective specifically focused on trying to lift up and empower Black women artists.
I had read that about her. I think that's awesome.
I think it, you know, it's absolutely beautiful that like she's not finding the support system that she felt like she needed at that time. It's there's a vacuum for that kind of thing. And and she fills the void. She steps in and steps up to not only help herself, but to help other people in that situation.
Yeah. The art was her voice. The art gave her a voice all through, didn't it? And she just kept doing it. She just kept doing it.
100%. 100%. I mean, so many of these artists' stories are all about the persistence and the resilience of the artist. After college, you know, she teaches for a while. She goes on to get her master's in education. She travels through Europe. 1961, she comes back when her brother passed away.
Oh.
1962 is where she gets the name Ringgold. She married Burdette Ringgold. And like I said, in the 70s, 1973 is when she quit teaching to focus specifically on art making as her full-time job. And she started off kind of painting. I look at her earlier works in the painting, and I see a lot of similarity to like Jacob Lawrence in the style. There's a sort of flatness to the stylization.
Kind of primitive.
I struggle to describe it because it feels flat. It feels almost like synthetic cubism almost.
There's
this simplicity to the rendering that I always look at that sort of raw aesthetic that feels almost like it could be an untrained artist or a self-taught artist as trying to tap into something that is just deep and innate. And because, you know, when it feels overly polished, it feels studied, it feels less expressive in some ways.
Less authentic, maybe.
Yeah, less authentic. And her earlier works, you know, she's tackling a lot of issues of social justice. She's focusing on political issues. And I think, you know, she said in the 1960s, you know, she's explaining her American People series, saying, "I couldn't act like everything was okay. I couldn't paint landscapes in the 60s. There was just too much going on."
I'm proud of her for that.
It takes courage. It sure absolutely does. Takes courage to speak up and share your experience when your experience is not so great. But she didn't dwell in the negativity. She took action.
Yes.
And eventually she shifted away from sort of painting more towards quilts, although she still like paints on the quilts.
Yes. But her fiber art is awesome.
Her fiber art is awesome. And that's what she's really best known for. And I think even the choice of the quilt is in some ways a political statement. And I think a lot of people don't necessarily think of it in that way. But like when you think about it, she shifted towards a traditionally overlooked material. You know,
yep.
I mean, quilts have been made by traditionally women for the longest time, and they were traditionally written off as a craft, as a functional object, and not viewed through that lens of fine art.
Except amongst the ladies.
Yes. And I'm not to say, I don't want to say that nobody viewed or respected it, but you know what I'm saying? Like,
yes.
There weren't a lot of galleries and museums clamoring to get the great quilts.
No.
It was all about the paintings and the bronzes and the marbles. And and she consciously chose that medium because of its rich tradition in, you know, as an art form for women, but also the personal connection with her own family. You know, she talked about how she learned from her mother and her grandmother, and she was continuing the methods that she learned from them.
And I think that's great that they helped her with that to express herself however she felt the need.
Yes. And I also thought it was interesting. I did not realize this until I was doing a little bit more research. So Faith Ringgold, she started off on quilts. She's wanting to tell a story. You know, she's making these story quilts, which I knew about that, obviously. But I didn't realize that she was doing the stories on the quilts because she couldn't get published.
Oh, yeah.
She was trying to write her story and tell her story and put out her autobiography, and like none of the publishers would touch it.
No.
And she said that what she did was she started putting the story on the quilt because then when it went up in the gallery wall, so many people in the gallery space would see it. And then it would be photographed for magazines, periodicals, sometimes in art books, and it would be published in that way.
And her stories had an impact that way because she used a different way to get it out there.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so she was successful in creating an audience for her stories because eventually she did get published.
She did
get not only Tar Beach, she has written and illustrated 17 children's books.
I didn't realize it was that many.
Yeah, it's quite a few.
Great.
The most famous of those books was Tar Beach. Mm-hmm. The book was published in 1991 based on the quilt of the same name that she created in 1990. And so after the break, we're going to talk about that specific work, Tar Beach.
Do you find it hard to sleep at night? Then the Calm Cove podcast can help you sleep deeply all night long. Calm Cove has deeply relaxing meditation music and ambient sounds, like ocean waves and crackling fires. All of our episodes are designed to help you relax and to fall asleep fast. Calm Cove is brought to you by the team behind Sleep Cove, the sleep podcast that consists of spoken word hypnosis, meditation, and stories. So if you want to listen to a beautiful soundscape tonight, search for Calm Cove on Apple Podcasts or Spotify and see how we're helping millions of people relax and go to sleep every night. Do you find it hard to sleep at night? Then the Sleep Cove podcast can help you. Hi, I'm Christopher Fitton, the voice and clinical hypnotherapist behind Sleep Cove. SleepGo features sleep hypnosis, meditations, and bedtime stories, all designed to help those of you who struggle at night to achieve a restful and peaceful night's sleep. Search for Sleep Cove on Apple Podcasts or Spotify and see why Sleep Cove helps millions of people sleep deeply all night long.
Have you ever wondered who the Mary was from Bloody Mary? If the Loch Ness Monster was real, or if Ouija boards actually worked? On each episode of the family-friendly Unspookable, we look at the histories and mysteries behind your favorite scary stories, myths, and urban legends to get the real stories behind the scares. Want to solve your next mystery? Find and follow Unspookable now wherever you get your podcasts.
Here we are. We're looking at Tar Beach. This was the first and probably most famous story quilt created by Faith Ringgold. I think it's at the Guggenheim.
Yes.
And just as we're looking at this, what are you seeing? What's jumping out at you?
The kids laying there really relaxed, having a great time looking at the stars.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the kids laying out on, I guess, you know, the story of Tar Beach, I should probably give the quick overview for those who aren't familiar, and I will link to the story in the show notes for this episode. But the story of Tar Beach is, you know, the Tar Beach she's talking about is on the rooftop in the building, like thinking about kids in the city. They don't go to a literal beach. They've got the tar beach on the roof. And she's talking about her sort of fantasies of flying over the city and claiming things, flying over buildings and bridges and things like that. And as she flies over them, she claims them and they become hers.
That's neat.
And so it's that sort of childhood daydreaming type fantasy. And yeah, the kids laying out on that stark white blanket. Uh-huh. That certainly grabs my attention as well.
Immediately. She did a good job getting your attention there.
And I think one of the things that's interesting about that, as I'm looking at it, and maybe this is just me, but the blanket that they're laying on has like a floral border that kind of reminds me of the border of the Tar Beach quilt.
I bet you it's the same.
You know, like I wonder if that's meant to be sort of a...
It definitely matches color-wise.
I wonder if that's meant to be sort of a meta reference within the work.
Could be. And she's got the whole story written out in white at the bottom of the quilt, which is amazing.
Yes, she did. She wrote out the story across the bottom and the top. And as I'm looking at it, there's this sort of patchwork of floral prints that frame, like little squares of different floral things that are framing it, that seem to make a patterned border. And then in the center square, we have essentially painted fabric that is illustrating the central scene of the entire story, with the adults sitting at a table on the rooftop while the kids are laying out on a blanket.
They've just had a picnic.
Yeah, it just seems like a picnic. It seems like it's probably a hot summer day. Maybe you don't have air conditioning.
I bet she didn't.
You know? As I'm looking at this, though, I'm wondering about the construction of it. Is this the kind of thing where would you paint the fabric first or would you quilt it then paint it?
You would paint it first and then quilt through it. That's the normal routine with quilting on fabric art and paint going together. Yeah, she quilted it down afterwards. She probably used a clear monofilament thread so it didn't show on the paint.
Yeah, because I can see essentially like indentations where the stitched lines would be, but I don't see the thread itself, which... I was curious about, would it have been sewn through the back of it somehow? Or you're saying it's just a clear thread that goes through?
I'm thinking it's a clear thread that goes through it so it doesn't disrupt the picture at all. It just quilted it down.
Yeah.
That's what I'd have done if I was making something like that.
It's interesting. And I think it's kind of cool the way that, like, you can see so much happening in here. It's like you, and I see the repetition of the little girl on the blanket and then that same little girl flying through the sky.
Yeah.
So we get to see, like, the real and the fantasy simultaneously, which I think
is neat.
It's an interesting way of portraying it.
Yeah, because she's looking back down on herself and looking at herself. It's really cool the way that worked.
Yeah. And as I look at this, I'm just struck by the colors. I see these different remnants of fabrics. It's funny. It's like borders upon borders upon borders to it. I wonder.
Yes,
why
she's definitely done a lot of piecing on the border.
Yeah, and I wonder why that would be. I wonder if in some ways it just makes more of a connection to that tradition of like patched fabric.
Probably. I'd say that is a statement on making do with what you have.
Yeah, that's a good point. It has this remnant feel to it because there are so many different bits to it.
Well, and these kids are making do with their tar beach because they don't have grass and a park to run in. And so she made the border make do also.
Yeah. I think, yeah, there is some sort of unification to that that reinforces sort of that central feeling or central tone to it of, you know, taking what you've got and making it into something
life
even
gives
greater.
You lemons, yeah. Make the lemonade.
Yeah, in some ways. And I think, you know, taking that functional object and elevating it and finding a way to get your voice heard and your story out there, like all of that seems to be
encompassed in this one work, isn't it?
Thank you. Because I was trying so hard not to say it's all of those different threads stitched together in here.
And it's such a personal statement. I admire her willingness to share, you know, her personal, that's her story she's sharing with you there.
Yeah, it's interesting because it's personal and somehow universal at the same time.
Yes, because everybody's been there.
And I think that's a tough line to walk.
Sure is. She's a brave woman for as far as I'm concerned.
It certainly is. And, you know, the other thing I don't think we even talked about, one of the things that I read about why she was doing the quilts on, or why she was making the work on quilts, another reason aside from like the cultural and family traditions that she's carrying on and elevating a marginalized art form, it was also she wanted something that she could handle herself. It wasn't a big, heavy canvas that she would need someone else to pick up and transport. It was something that she could easily roll up and bring into the gallery herself.
That's a good thought.
And so I think it's kind of cool that she's also finding ways to just, you know, navigate that and become, and, you know, assert her independence in her work.
Well, and I'm absolutely certain her doing her art form in quilts with fabric helped to elevate other women who make art quilts because she did it at an early time.
She did. I feel like in some ways this is like this laid the foundation for artists like Bisa Butler, who today is doing just jaw-dropping work.
Wow.
Out of quilts. I mean, if you've seen her work,
I
did an episode on her maybe a year ago or something, but it, you know, she is making just stunning work that feels like it's painted, although she is taking just different colored remnants of fabric and all sorts of different colors and stitches them together to create the shapes of different colors. So it's not like she's painting
paint by number kind of thing.
It is almost like that. It's like, you know, because she is another artist who was trained as a painter, but she would do like, okay, this is the way I would paint it with these shapes of different colors and stuff like that. And then she takes fabric and cuts it to those different shapes for each of the color separations and does
time
layers
consuming.
And layers. Very time consuming and very much above my skill level, my level of expertise in fibers.
Like I was going to say, I can sew, but I haven't quite gotten that far yet.
Well, it's not just the sewing. You just think of like the cutting skills.
Oh,
that's what it takes.
You know, the time.
It's a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
But I guess we should probably get back to Tar Beach here. As I'm looking at it, I find it interesting the composition. She did actually more than one version of Tar Beach. This one we're looking at is number one, which is focused a lot on that rooftop. And then in number two, she does more where we see like the skyline more prominently. Every time I look at this, I'm a little conflicted because on the one hand, I like the emphasis of like the rooftop and everything like that.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, there's so little of the sky. And I feel like the story is so much about that elevation and going into the sky and the fantasy of flying. I wish I saw a more vast sky in here.
I get that too, because that'd be more part of the story.
Yeah. And I guess that wish is fulfilled in Tar Beach 2, which is a little bit, it feels a little bit more sort of fantasy here.
I didn't know there was two versions of that.
Oh yeah. Yeah. There's more than one. I can send you a link to number two here. I think it's like a lot of artists, once they find, you know, what's working and what's resonating with people, it's like
they go with that.
Well, you got to play the hits, you know.
Yeah. Oh, I do like that one. I like that one a lot better because it does have more of the sky scene going on, more of the imagination.
Well, I think that's interesting. I think the brightness of the colors in Tar Beach 2, like Tar Beach 1 feels much more like, it's much more muted.
Muted and older.
And it feels more true to what the city looks like, you know? Yeah. But when you look at Tar Beach 2, it feels more to me like a kid's view of things being a little bit brighter. And yes, there are the gray drab elements, but like the reds and yellows in Tar Beach 2, it's like primary colored brightness.
There's more of a childish whimsy to this one.
Yeah, which to me just it feels more fun. I like that child's viewpoint, especially on something that is supposed to be about that child's viewpoint.
Yeah, it works well.
And I like the way that the text, well, actually, I'm conflicted about the text, because on the one hand, in Tar Beach 2, we see the text is sort of spread throughout the composition.
Right.
We see it's integrated into that picture. We see the story and picture together. In Tar Beach 1, the story is laid out within the border at the top and the bottom. And that makes it a little easier to read and easier to follow.
Yeah.
But it's separated. It's, you know, like you look at the picture and then you look at the text. Whereas here, you're kind of doing both at the same time a little bit more.
Yeah. They're scattered throughout the sky like that. I like that, though. I think that makes it more interesting.
So between the two, I guess this is a question I've never really asked my guests, but because we've got two versions of Tar Beach here, you know, I do wonder, which do you feel is the more successful overall?
I would think her first one probably was.
You like the first one?
Mm-hmm.
I like the rendering of the figures in the first one. They feel a little bit more.
The skyline looks pretty realistic too.
Yeah. And I like the rooftop composition for the first one. Mm-hmm. I like the feel of the second one overall.
I get that though. Believe me.
But there's, yeah.
You just like the mood of the second one better, don't you?
Well, I think I like a couple of things. I like the way that, just from a compositional standpoint, I like the angle of the bridge. I like the balance of it with more of the sky being visible and the figures flying through the sky being more prominent.
Yeah.
As a grown man with the mind of a child, I like the brightness of the color and the way that those bright colors are distributed, because there are pops of yellows that are nicely spread across the composition to balance it. And the rooftop becomes this triangular wedge that points my eye up at the true, like, focus of this story of the figures flying in the sky. Like, we understand
works to do that.
Yeah.
The triangle.
Yeah. Because, like, we have the big triangle of that rooftop, which is, it's pulling my attention. Like, I understand that has a certain amount of visual weight that grabs my attention. I understand that's one key focal point. And then it also, because it's triangular, it's an arrow pointing me up at the counterbalancing, equally important, if not arguably more important, of the fantasy. And I think there's something really nice about that. At the same time, like, the first version feels a little bit more sophisticated in a lot of ways. I'm conflicted, but I think I probably go with number two.
Well, we could differ on that one, can't we?
I think there's room to respectfully disagree on stuff.
Yeah, there is.
Especially stuff that's just a simple matter of opinion and personal taste.
Exactly. Yes, everyone has those.
And I'm wrapping it up. I want just a 3-point rating scale. And where should this hang? The Louvre? Is this something to look at? The lab? Is this something to learn from? Or the loop. British for the bathroom.
Yeah, there's a poop joke in there somewhere.
Oh, that's terrible.
Where do you think this piece belongs?
I think that it belongs in the Louvre because it makes such a statement. And she was brave enough to speak out at a time when women were supposed to be seen and not heard. And I just think it makes an important statement. And I think it needs to go in the Louvre.
Yeah, I can't really argue against that point. I mean, her work has so much that is not only, like, strong visually, because, like, it's pleasant to look at.
Yes.
You know, like, when I think of a museum piece, I want it to work on a couple of levels. And I agree. This one, it's nice to look at. Either version, I struggle to decide which one I like better, because they're both good in different ways, but they're both pleasing to look at. And I also think, like you said, this hits at a couple of different levels of significance for her personally and culturally. You know, just to bring this full circle, at the very beginning, she was saying how she grew up in the Depression, but she wasn't hindered by it because she had that loving, supportive family. And we see here in Tar Beach, she is surrounded by those people that she loves, and she's putting that out on a quilt, which also the other thing that I absolutely love about the connection of the quilt as a medium is the quilt it's a symbol of security. It is warmth. It
comfort.
Is safety. It is that comfort. Mm-hmm. You know, when you're feeling sick, you seek the comfort of a quilt. When you're wrapped up. And so she's creating something that is warm and cozy in terms of the narrative, but also the material that she's laying it out on. And I think that is something that is beautiful that we can relate to in any number of different ways.
That is powerful. She put it on a medium that creates security and comfort like her family gave her.
Yeah. And she's passing it on to the rest of us to see and appreciate. And I do love that. And I think that's why it deserves its place in the museum. And it's why so many thousands, if not millions, of people have enjoyed the story of Tar Beach.
Yes.
Well, thank you very much for taking the time to talk with me about Faith Ringgold and Tar Beach. Once again, Myrtle from A Series of Dysfunctional Events. Check it out in your podcast app starting October 1st.
Thank you for having me. I've had a great time.
Well, thank you.
This concludes this week's episode of Who Arted, part of the Airwave Media Podcast Network. If you found this tolerable, please leave a rating or review on your favorite podcast app. You can find images of the work being discussed this week and every week on social media at Who Arted Podcast on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok, and of course on the website whoartedpodcast.com. Podcast done.